The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gap number 299er for Thursday, November 18th, 2010. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gap, a premium show. For all of our premium subscribers, thank you very, very kindly. This is our second premium show of November. There might be a third. I don't know. But we'll let you know, and you'll know. Of course, I'm Dave Hamilton here from Durham, New Hampshire. And on the other end, of course,
John F. Braun here in Fairfield, Connecticut.
I think we're alone now, John. Pete's flying today. So
he's always flying.
I know. Yeah.
No, he's not.
No, he's not. That's right. So we've got a bunch of stuff to go through. Let's start with this thing that has totally monopolized our pre-show, and we'll just dive right in.
Hello, John, Dave, Pete. This is Tom from Detroit. I'm just calling about the Fire Sheep thing that you mentioned in your last premium episode. And it's about WPA. WPA actually does protect you from Fire Sheep. WPA negotiates a key when you log into the router, and then that key is used to unencrypt your conversation with the router, so it can't be stolen the same way.
Right. Okay, I'm sure there's more we're going to talk about here. So what I've learned, and Fire Sheep is this Firefox plugin that allows the user of the plugin to sniff the traffic that goes by in the air and pull out the authentication information that's required to allow them to masquerade as you on sites like Facebook, Amazon, Google, etc. What we have learned since then is that FireSheep's not looking at the entire network. All it's doing is looking at your wireless network. So FireSheep does not work over Ethernet, based on all the tests that we've done here and based on everything we've read. And also, as Tom pointed out, FireSheep does not work over an encrypted wireless network that's using WPA, because each connection is being encrypted between the computer and the router. So you can sniff the traffic, but it's not going to mean anything to you because you don't have the key to decipher it. Is that and I know there's more to talk about there, John, but you agree? Did I get that right so far?
I think you got it so far. Yeah. In general, I think the caution with this tool, or just in general, like we found at a recent show we went to, is you got to be real careful on any open network where you just have to put in the SSID and not provide any sort of key. Because then, as the creator of this says, it's really meant to leverage what's happening on an open Wi-Fi network that doesn't use any sort of security.
Right. Now, if you are on an open Wi-Fi network, we did talk about a couple things last show, using a VPN, or even simpler, connecting using HTTPS. And that also encrypts the connection, not just between you and the router. It actually encrypts it between you and the host to which you're connecting. So you've got an encrypted connection there. But sites like Facebook don't support SSL for whatever reason. I don't know why, but I guess it's a slightly increased server load, and when you've got 500 million users or something ridiculous like that, then that kind of thing probably matters.
So, well, I think the thing is more by default, Dave, it doesn't, because if
it doesn't try to connect to Facebook with an HTTPS, it'll turn you right around, and before long you'll see that S is gone.
All right, well, I'm typing in right now. I got https://facebook.com.
yeah. Go ahead and log in. See,
but I see what you're saying is at some point it'll switch back.
Yes,
to regular.
Oh, that was my experience with it. Yeah, which is a shame. because it, you know, Google will allow you to connect with HTTPS, but, and maybe Facebook will too. I when I tried it,
You're right. Okay. So I just logged in and yeah, I'm on http://. So it undid the HTTPS.
Yep. Yeah. And if it worked with HTTPS to even get there once, then it works. There's no more problem. I don't know why they're redirecting us back to the non secure version, but they're all set up for it. I think it's just some of their redirects point you there. If you take any Facebook link and put an S in front of it, it will work. But the links that you click on the page are not secure. So
anyway. I think the thing is, because it's performing encryption, it does introduce some overhead to maintain that connection versus a regular one. And I guess when you're talking millions of people, I mean, you know, of course they're not running on a single server, but you know, that adds a, you know, load, and you may have to buy more servers. So I guess they, yeah, in the interest of performance, will switch that off when they think it's
when they can.
Right.
Yep. So anyway, so the long and short of it is, be very careful on unencrypted wireless networks, but if you're on a wired network or an encrypted wireless network, you don't have anything to worry about. Anything else on this before we move on to our next?
No, I'm going to play with it a bit more. Going to play with it a bit more. The way it works is certainly not intuitive, though. When you install it in Firefox, you and I had a kind of rough time, and that I had to manually open the sidebar that had the tool until I was able to get it to show anything. So
right. All right, Ron writes, with regards to Mac Keycap 296, I use SugarSync. SugarSync has the advantage of syncing only folders that I designate in situ. There is no one special folder. It syncs seamlessly in the background. The files I designate are always perfectly in sync between my MacBook Pro and my aging Mac Pro. There is file sharing and other benefits as well. An iPhone and iPad app are available, and any sync data is available on your mobile devices. It also works with Windows. It's $5 per month for 30 gigabytes, but there is a free 30-day trial. I have no stock in the company, just don't know how I'd get along without it. So that's tip number one. Tip number two, he says, another tidbit I never see mentioned, but is crucial to file sharing. When one makes a folder public and designates a user, one must control or right click on the user. This is in sharing, system preferences, sharing, and then file sharing. One must right click or control click on the user and select apply permissions to enclosed items. Otherwise, one cannot access any of the folders in the mounted volumes. So thank you, Ron. That's helpful stuff. Very, very interesting about SugarSync. I like that you have the ability to select folders. Dropbox is starting to give you some of that. Again, Dropbox will give you 2 gigabytes, 2.5, as we talked about, for free. But then, but beyond that, you've got to ante up. But Dropbox, you have one folder where everything is, but you can selectively disable subfolders therein. So depending on how you do it, you could. Could manage this, but sounds like SugarSync has a way of doing that. That's just a little bit better. Anything to add, John?
Nope, I'm with you.
All right. And our last tip before we get into questions from Jeff, he says, several times in the last year, I've tried hooking up my MacBook Pro to my LCD TV to watch movies. However, each time the picture is rather dark and desaturated, which makes it very hard to watch. Playing with the settings on the TV never works that well. Turning up the brightness helps some, but then the contrast is terrible and the picture is crummy. I finally found the problem. The Mac was setting the color profile for the TV to a generic VGA profile. After switching it to Adobe RGB, the brightness and gamma was much better, saturation was great, and it was a lot like watching movies on my cinema display. Okay, so what Jeff is talking about is, if once you connect the external monitor or TV or whatever it is, go into System Preferences, Displays, and then for that display, you'll see it will open up a window on each monitor, and it's unique to each one. But you want to go to the monitor that you want to edit and go to color. And he's using Adobe RGB. You could actually select any one of the profiles there and check it out, or you can hit calibrate and create your own profile based on what you want to see. It'll kind of walk you through some steps. It'll tell you slide this slider until you see things a certain way and then move on to the next step. And you can use that to create a profile that perhaps is better for you.
Yeah, and I wonder, because there's a checkbox in there, I wonder if this would have prevented this problem called show profiles for this display only.
Hmm.
And I'm looking right now on my G5, all I have is SyncMaster, which happens to be the screen I have connected to that.
Right.
And on my MacBook, it says Color LCD, and that's the only one it shows. So I wonder if at some point, someone may have unchecked that box and selected the wrong one. Or as you point out, Calibrate is, I've never had to use that, but that's the
Oh, that's fallback. Fun. I've done that with almost every display I've gotten just because I like to tweak around with stuff.
Oh,
right. Yeah, it's fun. I mean, I don't know if my eye and judgment is better than anyone else's, right? So, you know, you might come and say, oh my gosh, why is your screen so green? Or whatever, but you know, it is what it is. Works all right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Moving on to our questions here. And how come I can't find the question? I know I put them in here, John. Apparently I didn't put them in here. Uh-oh. Makes me think I've got a syncing issue between my my computer downstairs and my computer up here. Might have a Dropbox problem, because I use Dropbox to sync my Yojimbo these days because MobileMe was acting up. So I'm going a different way to find Rick's comment. And here we go. Rick says, ever since updating to the latest iTunes and Mac OS X versions, I get a box every time I start up iTunes that says, do you want iTunes to accept incoming network connections? I have the firewall enabled, but I have added iTunes to the exclusions list. I also reset warnings in iTunes, but all to no avail in eliminating the need to click on this accept each time. Any thoughts would be great. All right, John, go.
Okay, I got two things here. So one, I had the same thing happen, Dave, and I didn't really think anything of it. In the, you know, iTunes, I clicked on the button and I was happy. It wasn't a big deal. But then when I got this message, when I saw this in our mailbox, then I thought, you know, this is really bothering me because it shouldn't be doing it. It's never done it before. I haven't changed my firewall settings or anything.
Sure.
So did a little digging here. And the bottom line is I'll tell you the command that I issued to find out that something was amiss with the iTunes application. So one of the settings in the firewall that I have activated and I trust works properly. Let me bring it up here. So you get a security and then firewall.
And inside the system preferences, right? System preferences, right. Security, firewall. Okay. Yep.
And I think it says, you know, allow signed applications. Let me get the exact wording here.
Oh.
I'm sorry. So there's an advanced button, and one of the checkboxes says automatically allow signed software to receive incoming connections, which sounds like a good thing. Now, we're not going to go into a lot of detail about what signed software is, but suffice to say, you know, signed software means that you trust who has issued the software is a legitimate organization.
Well, what
Apple?
What happens is you can Apple. I think they require it certainly for iPhone apps, right? But Mac apps can be code signed. I think that's what we're talking about here.
Yes. John.
Okay. So from what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, but code signing, you get a certificate from Apple that says yes, you are John Braun. And then you bake this certificate when you build your application, you bake this certificate in and it says, yeah, this app was written by John Braun and John Braun, you know, has used his code signature to do that. Is that right? Essentially,
you're generating a signature based on the information in the certificate and the keys that are used to create the certificate.
Okay.
But it's a two-part process. So right. You have a piece of it in that you sign the code. And then what happens is when it's on the Mac, the other part of the equation is done, because since Apple has to issue this, so you get half of, to simplify it a bit, because it's all public key encryption and all that, but to simplify it, you have half of the puzzle, and the other half of the puzzle is in Mac OS X.
Got it.
Okay. So it'll check the application and say, okay, you know, did someone that I authorized sign this software? And then we're not going to get into the math, because that could be an entire podcast in and of itself.
Sure. Okay. But it essentially says that you've registered with Apple and Apple says that you're a developer. It is really, right. I mean, that's, it doesn't say anything more than that, right? But that's, but it does say that. Okay. So the code is signed and you're at least on a, on some level, you're cool to develop for OS 10.
Right. So I was surprised when this came up because iTunes, you know, is one of the applications that's signed. And yes, then I find that there's a command that you can execute on the terminal. Don't be afraid to verify if the signature is correct on a piece of software. And I type the following: code sign space dash V as in Victor space slash application slash iTunes dot app. What that's saying is, you know, verify the, that the signature on iTunes is correct. Now, if it's correct, you're not going to get anything back. But if it's not, you're going to get something like I got, which is, I don't even know what the heck this means. A sealed resource is missing or invalid. I'm like, what?
Really?
Yes.
Like not a seals in San Francisco Bay resource, but
it could be. I have no idea. I don't know what a sealed resource is versus an unsealed resource. So that indicated to me that the signature was not correct. Now, the way that I upgraded it, and I suspect the way that that Rick did it as well, was that he did it through software update.
Okay.
What I'm suspecting is there was something missing, or the install process didn't go quite as expected, because it said the signature on this thing's not right. So that's why it kept coming up and asking, you know, this question. And there may have been other things wrong with it. So what I did is trashed iTunes, tried to throw it away. It came up, here was a little hitch here, came up and said, whoa, 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 there's something called iTunes Helper running. You can't empty the trash. I'm like, okay. So go to Activity Monitor, you find the iTunes Helper process, quit that, then you can throw it away. And I downloaded, so rather than software update, I downloaded it right from Apple, downloaded iTunes, installed it, ran the code sign command again, everything was fine.
Yeah, and that, okay, so that, and that's,
then I had an error message back, and then when I started up iTunes again, I didn't get that message. Good. And Rick actually wrote back to us and said, yeah, what you suggested worked. So,
okay. So, yeah, so it's interesting because Apple uses that code signature for things like this, where you launch an app, if there's any permissioning that has to happen, it actually stores in a file somewhere inside OS X. It says, okay, yeah, the administrator of this computer has authorized this app to either run or talk on the network or whatever it is you authorized. And it stores the code signature if a code signature exists. And if it does, then life's a whole lot more convenient for you because you authorize once and then you never have to think about it again. But if there's not a code signature in there, then what you and Rick saw is exactly what's going to happen. It's going to ask you every dang time because it has no way of remembering it. And it's also Apple's way of encouraging vendors to make sure their apps are code signed. And that's not a bad thing. I don't think you've done more development than I do. Maybe there's some political implications there, but as a user, I think the code signing thing is actually pretty cool. So
it is, but even what I saw in Windows with earlier versions is that, you know, people were supposed to, but the problem is a lot of installers would come up and say, whoa, this, and it wasn't so much application software, but drivers and stuff like that. It would come up and say, whoa, it's not signed. You want to install it anyways?
Right.
And of course, you know, once you get in that case, Apple makes it pretty transparent that this is happening.
Yeah, most people wouldn't even know. I remember, you know, when apps started coming out with that were code signed, and I would see that in like the change log or something. And oh yeah, now our app is code signed. Like, what the heck is? Who cares? Why does that matter? And the more I read, the more I realized, oh, actually, that's kind of cool. Okay, good. Go ahead. You know, go forth and prosper. All right. You talked about killing off that little iTunes Connect thing. So I think the question that we have from Mac is a nice little segue here. Mac writes, I have a MacBook Air running 10.6.4, which when this question came in was the latest. I noticed that it was getting quite hot and the battery was draining rapidly. So I looked in Activity Monitor and found a process called Space Station D that was using 50 to 60% of my CPU. I found an application in my downloads called Space Station that looked like it had never been installed. I tossed the folder as well as a plist file. I killed the process. It came right back. I rebooted. I killed the process. It came right back. I sudo killed the process. It came right back. Note, since I tossed the folder and emptied trash, Spotlight no longer finds anything by the name Space Station. I safe booted. It was gone. I logged into my guest account and Space Station D is not there. Unfortunately, it appears to live in all my backups as well. How do I shoot down this Space Station? As an aside, I vaguely remember downloading something a long time ago that was going to tell me when the International Space Station was overhead, but I don't ever remember using it. How do I shoot down this space station? John?
Not that we support shooting down space stations.
No, that's right. But it's going to take more than a rocket launcher, I tell you.
And I remember solving a similar problem for someone. So here's what's happening. And this gets kind of geeky. This really gets underneath the covers more of how Unix operates. So there are a couple of folders on your system. One of them is your home folder /library/launch agents. And another is regular, start at the top, /library/launch agents.
Yep.
And what's in there is a bunch of plist files. And what these plist files do is submit information to something called LaunchD. LaunchD is like the new grand unified way that Apple's Unix would like you to use to start things up when the system runs.
Would it be fair to call it a process manager, kind of the granddaddy?
Sure.
Major?
Sure.
Process? Okay, good.
Yeah, I think before there were a number of different ways to run things when you started up the OS, and it was a real mess. So at some point, Apple said, no, let's use LaunchD.
I think it was Leopard. I think it was 10.5 when LaunchD became 10. No, I think 10, I don't know, whatever. Now it is. That's all that matters. It was at least 10.5. It may have been 10.4.
Right. Now, what you can do is, and usually these files have names that hint at, you know, the process they're invoking. So I'm sure the plist file that invoked this had, you know, space station or something similar in its name. So what I did is I started examining some of the plist files in my launch agents folder. And these are plist files like anything else. And you can open them with property editor, or BB editor, or, you know, a lot of different programs. And there's one flag in these, Dave, and here is the key. There's one flag in the plist file called keep alive.
Oh. So shoot down the space station and it relaunches into the air.
So what that says to me, so what keep alive, so it's optional because there may be processes where if the user deems it necessary to kill it off, it goes away. For whatever reason, when this software was installed and something was put in launch agents, these guys decided, you know, this is so important that even if somebody kills it off, but this is my best guess, is that's what keep alive does.
Okay. Yeah, it sounds reasonable based on the
what was happening is that it's like, oh, you went away? Okay, well, I'll start you up again.
Yeah, and that can be really handy. If you've got some process that should be running all the time, if it dies, it's great to have LaunchD kind of sitting there saying, hey, wait, that process isn't running. Let's fire it back up again. That, you know, that's helpful in when you want it to be helpful.
Right. So one way would be to look at these plist files, you know, to find the appropriate one and get rid of it. Another thing is that there's something that still works. It's kind of dated, but it's called Lingon. And that will let you view in a nicer way the various things that are in launch agents. And there are a couple of other folders that contain things that happen when the system starts up. So my suggestion was look for the plist file that, you know, has a name that resembles this process being started. Toss that, restart your system. You should be fine. And I think the email that we got back from Mac was a bingo.
Great. That's awesome.
Which to me indicates success. So, but unless you know that stuff is there, this could be an infuriating problem.
So I was going to investigate another solution. And I started to, and John, when you listen to the show back, you'll hear there was a little stuttering in your Skype stream because I was doing some things that were about to cause, you were intelligible. And I apologize to both you and the listeners, but there's an audio interrupt thing that happens when you start crunching on the disk a lot. And what I wanted to do was I figured, this is one way of finding this thing, but let's say he just wants to get rid of the file, because if he gets rid of Space Station D, doesn't matter how obsessed Launch D is, it's not going to start a process that doesn't exist.
Right.
So, and he said he looked in Spotlight for it. Well, there is Spotlight only by default searches user files. And John, I'm going to ask you to take a look at your Spotlight on your Mac. When you do a search, you'll see a little plus. As soon as you start doing a search in the Finder, you see a little plus button appear below the header and before the search results. Is that right, John? Yes.
Spotlight.
So you're in the Finder, and
right.
Maybe I can do this while I'm talking because it's not going to cut out Skype, but maybe it is. So, you know, if I start searching for whatever, you see a thing where it says search this Mac, contents, file name, whatever you're looking for. And then over on the right, there's a little plus sign. And this is in the subheader in the Finder between where you're typing the term you're searching for and the results. And if you hit the little plus sign, you get a little drop down option. And on most systems, kind is any is the first thing you see there. And what you want to do is change kind. And you're looking for system files, because by default, system files are hidden from Spotlight searches. If you do not see system files in this list, you can click other and pick it from that list. But that's it's a much bigger list. But you want to say you want to turn on system files, or you want to say system files either aren't included or are included. And when you choose are included, it's going to search everywhere on your Mac, and that is going to find where that Space Station D, the actual daemon itself, the little binary file is, and you should be able to delete that right from there. And that will keep it from running. It won't get rid of the plist file that tells Launch D to start it. So Launch D will actually have an error in its log saying, hey, I tried to start this, but it doesn't exist. But that's not a huge deal. Better to get rid of both, of course, but that is the way to find the space station and as you said, Mac, shoot it down. So,
right, you're correct, because I remember someone else wrote in the past, and they had the problem that the Launch D was being persistent and it cluttered the console. So it's not, I don't think it was consuming any processor, but it was just blowing everything else out of the console, because that it was doing that every second or so.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it will obsess over it, because as we said, that's its job. All right. We have a question from another Jeff. Writes, about a year ago, I purchased Notebook from Circus Ponies because of their sponsorship of the show. I'm now looking at Yojimbo, as Notebook is not the best for me to use for my note scraps. The problem I'm running into is this: where do I draw the line between an item that goes into Notebook or something that goes into Yojimbo? They are both great programs, but because they overlap, it's difficult to know what goes where. Okay. They do overlap, and my guess is that many people could use one and never really find a need for the other, and vice versa. But I do see that for me, the usage cases for them are compartmentalized. I might feel differently if I only used one or the other. But to me, it seems like Notebook is best for organizing content whose general category or topic is known at the outset, and something for which you know you're going to have a lot of data. For example, a class you're taking, an event you're planning, something you're organizing, or even just something where you've got one major category that you know you're going to assemble a lot of information about, and you're going to pump all this stuff in. Whereas for me, on the flip side, Yojimbo, I use for kind of everything else, little scraps of information. I just throw them in there, and then I categorize them later. So it doesn't matter what the category is. I just throw it into Yojimbo, and then later on I figure out, oh yeah, okay, this is like a little tech tip, so I'm going to put this in my tech tips collection. And then that way when I'm looking for it, I know, oh yeah, yeah, that's a tech tip. Fine. And Yojimbo will show me everything that has no categorization. So if I want to, I can go back through and say, oh yeah, I should categorize these so that I can find them when I'm looking for them. So to me, that's where the differences are. Again, if you only had one or the other, you could probably go just fine. But this is a question we've got, Jeff, you're not the first to ask, is there a difference between these and what is it? So that's my take on it. And I figured a premium show is the perfect place to answer, because it seems like it's mostly you premium subscribers who have asked this, in the past. And I guess that's probably because you folks are, happy to spend money on the stuff we talk about here, which is great. I guess. Yeah. And we appreciate that. And as do our sponsors, of course, but yeah, so there's my answer on it. I don't think you use either one of those. Is that right, John?
Not often. Okay. So you're the expert.
Okay. Okay. Moving on to Javier has an interesting question. He says, I'm an avid listener, I'm writing because I need your help. I recently updated from a 2007 white MacBook 13-inch to a 2010 Mac Mini. I set it up as a home theater, and I love this thing, except for two nagging issues. Issue the first, I cannot add any items to my startup items list. Only the ones listed in the folder at the time I made the switch from my old Mac to the new one stayed. Anything else I try to add promptly disappears as soon as I log out or restart my Mac. I have fixed permissions, run all the scripts I could think of in Onyx, but the problem still persists. I'm running the latest version of Snow Leopard with all the updates. Also, I ran a test creating a separate user account, and that account works fine. Anything I add to the startup items folder there sticks and loads when I reboot. Also, when I switched computers, I used Migration Assistant to copy my user settings as well as the applications in case this matters. He then says, I have a second issue. My airport card seems to refuse to shut down. The Mac Mini is connected to the internet via Ethernet cable into my airport Extreme, which itself is connected to my Comcast modem and also via Ethernet. As I do not need my airport card to be running, I've tried shutting it off, but it refuses to do so. Other than that, I've disconnected my Ethernet cable from my Mac to test it, and it works fine. Okay, so... this is a very interesting thing. The airport problem sounds like there might be a driver issue. And the reality is that up until 10.6.5 came out, there was no way to install airport drivers from a default Snow Leopard. The only way you could get airport drivers for a Mac Mini was on the disk that came with it. So if you took a Snow Leopard DVD and updated it to 10.6.4, there was no way that you would not have the correct airport drivers, and you could have a mishmash of things. Mm. Yeah, it was a real mess. And my brother and I had to figure this out because he had OS 10 server on his Mac Mini and he wanted to go to OS 10. So we had to actually go and pull the airport drivers out of OS 10 server and kind of, you know, migrate them in. But so that makes me think, I know you said you used the Migration Assistant to get all your stuff over. But if I'm looking at this and thinking, you know, it's possible these two problems are related, you know, did you pull anything else over from one system to the other? You know, are you sure you didn't clone the drive or anything like that? That, you know, hopefully 10.6.5 fixes your airport issue. But it, you know, as I read this question, it was like these two things might not be unrelated, so that, you know, it may be that a reinstall of OS 10 from the Mac Mini disks was necessary here, although a 10.6.5 might at least fix the airport issue. As for the weird startup list thing, God, you know, that's all stored in a plist file. And if it works in one user account but not in the other, man, and permissions aren't an issue, I would, you know, permissions have been ruled out as an issue, I would blow away that plist file. It's home, library, preferences, and then login window.plist. Delete that and immediately reboot and come back in and see if you can modify the startup items. You're going to lose whatever was there, so make sure you remember or take a screenshot of what was there. And then that should do it. That should do it for you. I can't think of anything else that it would be, especially if it works in a test user account. You got any ideas, John?
No, I think, yeah, that the file is somehow corrupted if it's not permissions. Because, yeah, that's the only thing that I would think it would kind of yell at you if, you know, if you're trying to add something and it can't update the file. But
yeah, it should, but. You know, OS 10, it's interesting. It's important to remember that most everything you do, especially in system preferences, you know, most everything you're doing when you're clicking your mouse or choosing something from a keyboard or typing in or whatever, that is an overlay. What you're seeing is not actually where those settings are being stored, right? It's a very well-built overlay to modify essentially text files, and they're, you know, XML, and they might be binary in the end, but essentially you're writing text out to a file. So there are edge cases where the overlay and the file that it's modifying are out of sync with each other. And maybe, you know, maybe OS X thinks that it's writing to this file, and, you know, maybe it writes to it, but it doesn't reread from it. So it doesn't know to realize that the change that it thought it made, you know, it's got to make some assumptions at some point, right? I mean, it, obviously OS X is extremely robust, but clearly there's some points at which it sort of stops. And maybe this is one of them. I don't know.
Yeah, and I know you and I noticed the whole network thing, or the point at which Mac's where Migration Assistant wouldn't work, I think, is especially when they introduced the i5 and i7 machines, is that the processor was different enough that the kernel or something very deep in the OS was not.
But Migration Assistant should work for that. I migrated from PowerPC to Intel and it worked.
Actually, no, you're right. I'm sorry. Doing a direct copy of a drive because the parts of the kernel deep in the OS were just a little different.
Yes.
I mean, I would think, you know, an Intel processor is an Intel processor, but the i5 and i7, I think, were different enough that the old stuff just didn't know what to do.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. All right. Let's see what Jerry says. Let me pull up the right thing here. Jerry says, I have a specific and very odd problem with Apple Mail. I'm running mail on my ancient iBook G4, running Leopard 10.5.8, all updates applied. While I use Gmail for most of my own mail, I also have mail accounts for several clients that force me to use POP or IMAP accounts in a regular email program. My problem is simply this. I cannot access the preferences for Apple Mail. Using either the hotkey or the menu item causes the menu to flash once and then nothing happens. I'm right back in the mail application as if I'd done nothing at all. This does, of course, make it impossible to change the mail server settings. I did some research on Apple support and found a couple of old notes about this problem. None of these solutions seem to work. I've trashed the prefs file. Mail just builds a new one, which it still can't access. I'm at wit's end. Any suggestions? Wow, this is interesting because my first gut, yes. Right? You know, I put this in the show to kind of spur this little conversation here. My gut reaction would be, well, yeah, you know, quit out of mail, find your mail preferences file and get rid of it. And he says he's done that. Now, let's go through this and just make sure we're finding the mail preferences file. So it would be home, library, preferences, and then I believe it's com.apple.mail, if I'm not mistaken, and I'm looking here for the benefit of all involved. So he's got, yeah, com.apple.mail.plist. That's one place to look, but I'm guessing that's the preference file he went and removed. Also in mail, however, is in your library folder, is a folder called mail. And before you start digging in here, and you're going to start digging in here, but before you do, you should know that this is where all of your mail is stored. So don't go blowing away your library mail folder without knowing full well that you're going to get rid of every bit of email that mail.app sees on your system. However, if you come in here, you're going to see some other things. You're going to see an envelope index. You're going to see default counts. You're going to see message rules.plist. You're going to see message sorting.plist and some other things as well. Smart mailboxes.plist. So there are more preferences that are not part of the core mail preferences file. And my guess is that one of these is damaged. The envelope index is actually for keeping track of your messages. And there are times when deleting that is the right move. But in this case, you're not having a problem with your messages. You're having a problem with your preferences. So I would look at the rules, message rules.plist. That might be one where you've got some corruption out there because there can be a lot of data in that. Smart mailboxes, probably not, because it's pulling that every time you launch mail and the preferences wouldn't have anything to do with it. But preferences is where you edit rules. And it's possible that, you know, your mail app is set to go to the rules pane of your preferences every time you go there because that's the last place you visited. So that, to me, that's the the next place to go, because it sounds like a plist file issue. It's just The question is, you know, which one? Any thoughts there, John?
Absolutely.
All right.
So I noticed some other things in here. Now, I've never looked in here either, so we're kind of winging this as far as how to solve this. But another thing I noticed in the mail folder, Dave, is that there's a folder within the mail folder for each of your email accounts. And within that, it includes, it appears, it includes the name of the mail server. And I'm wondering
In the folder name itself.
Yes.
Correct.
So I'm wondering if that folder itself, maybe the permissions are wonky on that folder. So when you try to open the preferences, part of what the preferences are doing is trying to digest this folder. And if something's wrong with it or it's not there, I don't know, it may prematurely close. Now, of course, another place, you know, our favorite place to look here, Dave, is that, you know, some earth shattering like that happens, because that's a pretty big deal. Because I tried from scratch to create a, you know, mail account, and, you know, everything went swimmingly. I didn't run into any preference issues.
Sure.
But there may be something in the console that's saying, whoa, I can't find this, or permission, and their error processing is just not very elegant, and rather than giving you an error, it just gives up.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, console would be the place to look, and the trick there is get console launched first, click on all messages, and then go do whatever you want to do in mail and try and access the preferences, and then immediately switch to the console app and look and see what was reported very recently. It should all have timestamps. So, you know, match that up with your computer's current time and see if you can find an event that matches the time when you try to do the preferences. That might give you some insight there.
Yeah. And you can, you know, type in the search field mail just to filter out all the other garbage.
That's so smart, though. I never think to use the active search filters in console. And I totally should, because it would, you know, filters out all the cruft.
Well, the other thing is that you can dig down. I don't have this off the top of my head, but there are, I think it's in the files category in the console. There's a couple of hierarchies there, and there may be a specific log file for the mail application. I'm sure there is somewhere.
Yeah.
But, you know, the lazy way to do it, rather than, you know, digging through that, because there's a lot of stuff there, is just to, you know, do, I think, all messages and just, yeah, use the search feature.
Yeah, that's good. I like the search feature. You're going to need to remind me of that from time to time.
Okay.
Friend.
Use the search feature, Dave.
Okay. Thanks. I appreciate that. All right. Moving on to Mark. Mark writes, I have a problem with my 3.5-year-old Mac Mini overheating and crashing. I'm running 10.6.5 and connected to a second generation Drobo external Blu-ray drive and laser printer. I use the Mac Mini as a print file in iTunes server. It serves two Apple TVs, which it does with no problem. The overheating happens when I rip a DVD with Handbrake or a Blu-ray with Moya Blu-ray Ripper. And I'm curious, Mark, I want to hear more about this. And about 20% of DVD cases and in nearly all Blu-ray rips, the Mac literally overheats and keels over. However, as a temporary measure, I have been thinking outside the box and freezing a pint glass of water and placing this on top of the Mini as a heat sink. This bizarrely works and keeps the CPU temp to about 180, 190, which drops after the rip. But this is obviously no solution. I think the problem is temperature control. Maybe the fan isn't working properly or the airway is blocked. The final piece of the puzzle is that this issue didn't occur before I updated recently to 10.6.5. Has the temperature setting changed? So far, I have blown out the airway with compressed air. I have tried to find out if a fan is working okay, but can't find reference to it in the system profiler. And I've done a bit of Googling and found some fan control software, but none, not put them in, as I didn't think it was any use unless I know the fan is fine. I'm also thinking that maybe I'm asking the Mini to do things it doesn't have the power to do. So would a RAM update help? Or is this issue the 10.6.5 update? Should I roll back? And if so, how would I do it? All right. So it's a 1.83 gigahertz Core Duo Mac Mini. So it's not 64-bit, but that wouldn't, you know, I guess there is a 64-bit version of Handbrake out, but not Mac the Ripper. Any of that. I guess he wasn't using Ripper. He was just using Handbrake. So, but it sounds like his problem is happening when he is maxing out his CPUs for extended periods of time. Now, John, I know there's no, that shouldn't happen. I do things very similar to this. I don't do the Moya Blu-ray thing, but I do use Handbrake regularly on at least one of my machines. And so the CPUs sit it 100% for, you know, 2 hours at a clip, and it's fine. The fans kick up, it does what it's supposed to do, and everything is fine. So that's what he's describing shouldn't happen, or should it?
Shouldn't. Well, I would agree with you. Any machine, be a Mac or something else, if all the, you know, insides are working properly, when things get hotter, the fans or whatever mechanism they use to take heat away should turn on.
Right.
So I'm with you. I got to applaud him for the cleverness of the liquid heat sink there, though. I'd be kind of nervous having a glass of water near my computer.
Yeah, what he needs to do is get some Freon, right?
Right.
And do it that way. Encase the whole thing in some cool, inert liquid.
Yeah, liquid nitrogen, I think, was another good one.
That'd
I think
be a
didn't,
great
they,
idea.
Didn't they do that with the Krays? They used liquid nitrogen to cool them?
Was it nitrogen or was it Freon? I thought it was Freon, and they kept running it through a compressor to cool it off.
Yeah, those things got very hot. So yeah. The first problem here, Dave. All right, so I think he's on the right track here in trying to figure out what could be wrong. Now, I would agree that if the machine is not working properly, in that the fans are not coming on for whatever reason, then I would say the machine is doing exactly what it should. In that most processors, the Intel included, you know, have some sort of mechanism to say how warm it is, and once it gets to a certain point, it should say, you know, I don't want to fry myself.
Right.
I'm gonna shut down, or something else in the machine should do this, saying, all right, even though this shouldn't happen, it's getting too hot, and I gotta shut off.
Some sort of hardware fail-safe, right? You know.
Yeah, because there is because there are multiple temperature sensors in the machine, and it sounds like we asked. I'm not sure what he's using, but he has something that's showing the status of one or more of the temperature sensors. Yeah, because he says, well, you know, it's getting up to 180, 190 Fahrenheit.
Right.
I see.
That's right.
So the first thing that I would do, Dave, and I was surprised, but how do you know if the fans are working? Short of listening very closely. And as far as I could find, Dave, there is no way with the standard macOS 10 install to tell what the fan speed or speeds are, because there's almost always more than one fan.
That's right. Yeah, no, I would use iStat menus, because it's going to give you all the information you want, temperature and fan speed. And you can adjust your fan speed with it. So that would be my advice.
Or another one that we'll link to this, of course, is SMC fan control is another one where you can, I think similar to iStat, you can both view the speed of the fans. And most machines I've seen, I think, you know, they're always spinning at about 2000 RPM or something.
Depends on the computer. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So on the MacBook, by default, they're always spinning at 2000 and you can barely hear them. And then you'll hear them as the rotation speed increases. I would do that. I suspect one or more, I'm not sure how many fans are in that machine, one or more of the fans is not doing what it should.
Yeah, and I've seen a computer with a bad fan before, and SMC fan control and really anything that's reading that reading from the fan will tell you that the fan's not spinning. So if in fact that's the problem, then that'll fix it. It also could be that for whatever reason, you know, that isn't... It's an older machine. It's not that old, right? But it is an older machine. Somebody at Apple may have screwed something up in the testing. 10.6.5 might have had different tolerances for fans. And I don't know. Maybe they made some changes to, you know, lower change fan speeds or change the temperatures at which they kick on. And somebody might have simply screwed something up, and the fans in your machine are not kicking on by default when they should. Again, SMC fan control or iStat menus would allow you to kind of take control of that and adjust those settings. You might be able to, if you can crank up the fans, then you're probably going to be fine.
Yeah, and I think he's already taken care of. And the only other thing, but again, I think he made sure of this, is that, you know, especially the Mini, there's certainly a way where you could set it up where you're either blocking or, you know, like you don't want to put it on top of any sort of insulator, but I'm assuming that it's in a nice location and there's nothing, you know, close to it that could block airflow or, you know, keep the heat inside. You
right.
Know, like that don't have anything on top of it other than that glass of chilled water.
Right.
Because you feel the top of a Mini, or actually, you know, even my time capsule, and it gets pretty, it's pretty toasty.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's interesting. All right, let's, I think we got time for one more. You want to do Trevor here, John?
Why not? Yeah, that one made me happy.
Okay, good. All right, so this is definitely a very geeky one, but fun, especially for our own Mr. Braun here. So, I have a problem, Trevor writes. I'm using a 13-inch MacBook running 10.6.5, Snow Leopard. I just downloaded Xcode 3.2.4 and iOS SDK 4.1 for programming iPhone apps. However, when I opened Xcode, I got an error message. When I clicked continue, another one came up. I downloaded some sample code to mess around with called Photo Picker. When I first tried to build and run it, it failed. What did I do wrong? John, what did Trevor do wrong? What happened?
Trevor did absolutely nothing wrong. Because, so I've been, you know, learning Xcode slowly but surely.
And I guess I should point out that the error message says something about base SDK missing, right?
There were a couple of windows. That actually wasn't an error message. So he was getting dialogues that gave error messages. But so here's what led me to the solution here. And I did figure it out. So he downloaded this project. And I think, yeah, it's called iPhone Photo Picker. And you can actually, I think, get it at code.google.com/p/. And we'll link to this. But it's a nice little sample application. So I thought, you know, wow, that's weird. His Xcode must be screwed up or something. I don't know. So I downloaded that. And with many development environments, in addition to all of the code, whether it be C or BASIC or whatever the heck it is, you usually get something called a project file. And this kind of brings everything together in that, you know, it'll point to all the libraries and all the source code and hopefully make the project portable. So if you want to give it to someone else, rather than having to build it from scratch and assemble all these libraries and source files, which can be a pain in the neck, you just give them all that stuff and the project file. And in theory, they should be able to load it into their development environment and compile it, and everything's cool. Here's so what I did is I downloaded this, and you know, I dutifully clicked on the project file, clicked on, you know, build and run, and I got the same error he got. And I'm like, Oh no, because I know what I'm doing. I mean, you know, I know how to use Xcode. Then here's what caught my eye. As you mentioned, Dave. So it wasn't an explicit error message, but it was something that didn't look quite right. So in the upper left hand corner of the Xcode window,
yes,
it's going to list the SDK that it's using. And in the case of Xcode, you're probably either going to be using the iOS SDK or the macOS, whatever, SDK being Software Development Kit. And we're not going to go into details of what that is, but you need one of those present somewhere in order to create a program. And it's usually downloaded with Xcode. Now, here's the problem, though, is that okay, and in the section of Xcode where it indicates the SDK being used, where was it? You read it to me. I'm trying to look at it. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, it said base SDK missing. And I'm like, well, I've never heard of the base SDK missing SDK. I'm not aware of a product called base. So what I'm going to assume is that something that it expects there is missing. And here's how I found out what it was. So within Xcode, you double click on the project file and it'll open an info window that has all sorts of nitty gritty information about the project itself. And here's what caught my eye. In the base SDK section of that project window, here's what I saw. It said iPhone device 3.0 and in parentheses, missing.
Ah.
Whoops. So here's what happened. Whoever built this, whoever created this project file was using the iPhone device 3.0 SDK. And the problem was, is neither I or Trevor apparently have that SDK in our machine. So when we tried to build the project,
got it.
Now the thing is, it didn't say, and this is kind of a finger wag at, you know, at Xcode. I mean, some of the error messages, I mean, you saw the screenshots. They made absolutely no sense. It didn't say, dude, you don't have this SDK. It was bringing up all sorts of scary stuff. So basically what I did is clicked in that window and then it'll list all the SDKs that are on the machine. So I figured, I'll pick iPhone device 4.0. I think he said he's up to 4.1, but I don't have 4.1 yet, but I have 4.0. So all I did was change that, build it, and then I got another error. But this was a different error. So it compiled, but then I got an error saying, oh, code signing error. And that's because, so that's better. So what that said to me is it was able to build the application, but it wasn't able to do code signing. And as we kind of covered before, oh, isn't this neat how it kind of comes together? So all apps on the iDevices require
code signing. Right.
But you got to do something special to set up for that. And apparently my system's not set up properly for that yet because you got to generate keys. You got to get their certificate. You got to do that whole thing. So I'll fix that later. But that's only if you're trying to compile an actual application. The other choice that you have, and this is in that menu. So once you select the right SDK, you can click on the first window that you see. And there's going to be two choices. There's going to be device and there's going to be simulator.
Ah, so you compile for the simulator and then you're all right.
Which doesn't require code signing. What it does is it runs it in the iPhone simulator on your computer. And once I selected simulator,
good to go.
Everything worked.
Awesome.
So the problem here is a not very nice project file mechanism, in my opinion. It should have come up and said, dude, the SDK is not here. But why don't you get it? Because I actually tried. I thought the SDKs were missing on my computer. So I tried installing them, and that didn't help because that wasn't the problem.
Right. Right, right. Interesting.
All right.
So a couple of things to go through here. We have this, of course, was, however you want to look at it, show number 299, which means that our next show is show number 300, which is, you know, a milestone, in at least in base 10. And since we use base 10 to identify the shows, we might as well acknowledge this milestone. We've done some different things in the past for show 100 and 200. John and I kind of did walks down memory lane. We've got something that we're putting together. I think we're going to have quite a few guests coming on the show for number 300. And if we can make it all work, we will stream the audio live. I think we'll use Ustream, but video may be a little overkill for what we're trying to do. But we're going to try and stream the audio live if possible. If of course, it'll be pushed out to all the feeds once it's recorded. But if you want to know when that is happening, just read MacObserver.com. We will have something up by Monday morning. So Monday is the first day of the week after Sunday. Let me pull up my calendar here and tell you what date Monday is. But whatever this next coming Monday is, and I'm totally lost. 22nd. So by the morning of the 22nd, we will have something up on TMO indicating when that's going to happen, when that's going to go live. And we'll also push something out on our Twitter account, which, of course, is twitter.com/MacGeekGab. So you can follow that there. You could follow John at twitter.com/JohnFBraun. You can follow me at twitter.com/DaveHamilton. You can contact us. I know you folks know how to, but you can email us premium@MacGeekGab.com. Right, John?
Absolutely.
I think. I said premium@MacGeekGab.com. Does that work for you, John? Sleep with us.
Premium.
There he is.
@MacGeekGab.com. That's what you said, right?
I said premium@MacGeekGab.com is what I
Good.
Said.
Good. Just want to make sure you said premium.
I said, no. Premium. 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is...
4-3-3-5.
That's right. You can Skype us to Mac Geek Gab. You can leave iTunes comments and all that good stuff. We did publish an article detailing the Macworld Expo Hotel deal with the upgraded rooms that we have at the Intercontinental. So if you have any questions about that, you can go there. But essentially the deal is use our special link, sign up for your room. And really, that's it. However, just to make sure you get what you're supposed to get, we've set up a special email address that you can email in. Send us your confirmation number. We'll make sure with the hotel that you're taken care of. We'll contact them once the event is closer. And if you do email us at that address, we'll put you on a list and make sure you get tickets for Cirque du Mac and anything else that we can do for you. So I think that's it, John. We're out of here. I want to thank Michael Johnston from We Have Communicators. He converts this to AC, and of course the bandwidth is provided by CashFly. That's it.
Cool.
300 next. The last of the 200s is almost over. The 200s were good to us.
They were.
I wonder how the 300s will be. I'm hoping even better.
300. Like 300 baud.
Yeah. right, folks, have a great weekend. And John, is there anything you might want to end our 200s with? Is there anything you might want to tell them?
I just remind everybody, don't get caught.
Made up.